Well, good evening and welcome to the John Whitmer Show, sponsored by Wink Hartman and the Hartman Group of Companies. Very happy you joined us tonight. Gosh, it's so good to be back. I gotta tell you, 5 months without radio, I missed it. I really did. So good to be here at your local liberal resistance headquarters, where we proudly champion the conservative principles of limited government, individual liberty, free enterprise, and traditional values. You know, the things liberals love to hate, the things they can't stand, like, oh, I don't know, freedom, independence, liberty, you know, those kinds of things. Happy to have you with us this evening. If you'd like to call in, our studio lines are open. You can reach me at 316-869-1330 by email at john@knssradio.com, on Facebook and True Social at The John Whitmer Show, and on X, Twitter, at John R. Whitmer. Reach out. I'd love to hear from you. We've got a great show planned for you tonight, even though we've had to change a couple of things. Coming up here a little bit later in the second hour, we're going to talk with constitutional law expert Paul Kammerer. He is a longtime expert on the law, and he's going to share his thoughts on the verdict in the Trump hush money trial. Author Daniel Greenfield will explain why the DNC has switched to a virtual nomination for Joe Biden in order to avoid a floor fight at the upcoming Democratic National Convention. And, of course, we're going to be taking your calls. We're going to take your calls a lot tonight. Now, I had planned here in the first hour to have a Hannity and Combs style debate. We're going to start a new segment on the show once a month. We're going to start doing a, shall we say, we'll call it a conversation between myself and longtime local radio personality Greg Williams. He works here at Odyssey, and he and I are buddies. We talk whenever I'm in the studio. He's a great guy, but he's, you know, left of center. I'll be kind and say he's left of center. We constantly kind of rib each other on different topics. And I got to talking with him recently, and I said, Greg, why don't you come on the show? And we're going to, you know, basically do a point counterpoint on a particular topic. We had planned tonight to debate, discuss the merits of Joe Biden's student loan, you know, quote unquote, forgiveness program. Greg, unfortunately, texted me earlier today. He's not feeling well. But we're gonna reschedule it. We will do it again here later this month. We'll do it probably on the 14th, either next Sunday or the following. But we are going to have Greg on. I think it's going to be fast. I'm really looking forward to it. Hannity and Combs was a great show for those of you who don't. It's how Sean Hannity got started. He used to have debates with Alan Combs. That's kind of what I'm going for here. So I think it'll be a lot of fun. Look for that. Follow the John Whitmer Show Facebook page for updates on that. Real quick, I just want to do a little shout out of a former House colleague of mine, a sweet, gentle, just a one of the most genuine, warm people that I've ever had the privilege of knowing and serving with, Representative Les Mason from McPherson, is in the hospital. He's struggling. I'm not going to get into the details, but I my thoughts and prayers go out to Les and his family at this time. You know, just the most genuine person I served with. Everybody loves Les, both sides of the aisle. And it's just tragic news to hear what's going on with Les. And I just want to reach out and let his family know that I'm thinking of him. And very sorry to hear the news, what he's dealing with, and just wanted them to know that I'm thinking of him. So Les, just the sweetest guy. So I just wanted to put that out there. Excuse me. You know, let me address the elephant in the room. Thursday, it was a tragic day. It was an unfortunate day in American history. And regardless, and I've already seen the videos of some of these left-wing yahoos celebrating and, you know, having a just going crazy over that decision. And frankly, whether you like or don't like Donald Trump, and you can not like Donald Trump and still not like that decision, because that decision was horsepucky. From the outset, the mission of Alvin Bragg. He ran on getting Donald Trump, and he did. And the mission of the radical left, for that matter, has been clear. Prevent President Donald J. Trump from running for president by any means necessary. I don't think this is going to work, but that's what they're trying to do. And after failed impeachment attempts, all kinds of unnecessary scandal, lots of lies, they finally succeeded, sort of. But in a different way than they intended. Instead of diminishing the leading candidate for president, they've instead undermined the rule of law and our republic. I know the Democrats love to say our democracy. We're not a democracy. We're a republic. The potential persecution, or the political, rather, persecution of Donald Trump is the most egregious miscarriage of justice in our nation's history. This happens in banana republics under authoritarian regimes. Not here in America. At least it's not supposed to happen here in America. And yet Joe Biden and the left have behaved like third world dictators prosecuting their opponents. Can you only imagine if Donald Trump had done this to Joe Biden, what the left would be saying? And yet here they're just rejoicing, saying it's justice. It's justice. Our founding fathers are rolling over in their graves. And the claim that Trump falsified business, I mean, this whole trial is based on a house of cards. The claim that Trump falsified business records to conceal a separate crime rests on a dubious interpretation of an obscure and arguably inapplicable law. There's little evidence that Trump even knew he had violated campaign finance laws, let alone that he knowingly tried to conceal them. And even if he had, Alvin Bragg doesn't have the authority to prosecute them in the first place. And what little evidence there is comes from a serial liar who lied under oath and then admitted he stole from his employer. Not a credible witness. The chief witness has zero credibility, but when the judge is out to get you and the system is rigged, this is what you get. And even if Trump were guilty, the statute of limitations on his offense has already expired, but that doesn't matter in New York City, apparently. The prosecution was blatantly politically motivated. The judge was politically biased. Trump has been politically persecuted. As former federal prosecutor Ailey Honig notes in New York Magazine, Alvin Bragg ran for district attorney on a promise to indict Donald Trump, and he's done so. And the judge in the trial, Juan Merchan, donated to a pro-Biden, anti-Trump political operation in violation of rules barring New York judges from contributing to political campaigns. The judge's daughter, Lauren, is a senior executive at a liberal Democrat firm that has worked with top Democrats, including President Joe Biden. But there's no appearance of impropriety here. Nothing to see here, folks, as the buildings are burning behind them, as justice is burning behind them. This is what we're looking at. Trump's persecution was highly selective. No state prosecutor has ever cited federal election laws as a predicate state crime. The Manhattan DA hardly ever brings cases in which the sole charge concerns the falsification of business records. And the statute prohibiting conspiracies to promote a person's election through unlawful means has almost never been used. According to an analysis from the Washington Post, since 2000, no judge issued a single legal opinion concerning that statute until Trump's trial began this year. 24 years. It's never happened. But we'll make an exception for Donald Trump. Since the initiation of these baseless and biased trials, the American people have recognized them from what they truly are. Shameless attempts to dismantle a political adversary for his unwavering commitment to our country, to their opponents, to the people they don't want to lose to. The left's actions throughout this trial, along with those stalled in the courts, have only served to galvanize support for Trump. Look at his fundraising numbers. Meanwhile, Joe Biden sits around and says we must respect the rule of law while he himself ignores the U.S. Supreme Court's own rulings. That's the rule of law that they respect. They respect the laws they agree with and ignore the ones they don't. But heaven forbid Donald Trump call this trial rigged. That's quote unquote dangerous. As we enter the final 5 months of this presidential campaign, primary filing deadline is tomorrow. We know this won't be the left's last effort to bring down Trump. They know they cannot defeat him at the ballot box, so they will resort to any means necessary, lawful or otherwise, to prevent him from taking the oath of office. But this isn't over, and I'm telling you right now, brace yourselves. It wouldn't surprise me if Judge Mershon sentences Trump to prison. He's a Biden donor, demonstrated bias throughout the trial. Democrats and liberal activists are convinced Trump is a threat to democracy and must be stopped. So to them, prison is where he belongs. And they are demanding nothing less, so Joe needs to deliver. Don't rule it out. But make no mistake, their lawfare will backfire. Democrats just did the worst thing they could possibly do going into November. They reframed this election. Instead of it being just Trump versus Biden, it's now Trump versus the system. And it's now all of us as well. They're branding all of us as criminals too. There's a reason Donald Trump raised close to $60 million in the 24 hours since he was convicted. America is fed up with this nonsense. And more importantly, the true judge and jury will speak loudly in November. As I mentioned in the opening, we had planned to have longtime local radio personality Greg Williams with me tonight to start a new segment, sort of a Hannity and Combs style conversation between Greg and I, who will respectively present a conservative and liberal perspective on various topics. Tonight, we were going to debate the merits of Biden's student loan malarkey. He's not feeling well, but and we're going to bring Greg back in a week or two to have that conversation because I think it's going to be fun. And I think, I mean, I'm going to kick his butt, but, you know, he says the other way. We'll see. Greg thinks having you pay for someone else's college loan debt is a great idea, and I fundamentally disagree for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the fact that the Supreme Court has ruled it's illegal. And, you know, which reminds me, and it just points to the fact, again, Joe Biden responded to Trump's conviction by saying no one is above the law and we must respect the rule of law. But when the Supreme Court ruled he couldn't forgive student loan debt, Joe Biden said, quote, "I promised to ease student loan debt for millions of folks. The Supreme Court blocked me, but it didn't stop me," unquote. This is the same guy who got mad at Trump and said no one's above the law and we must respect the rule of law. Well, apparently not when it comes to your student loan buying vote program, because that's what this is. Let's be honest, that's all he's doing is buying votes. No one is above the law, and we must respect the law, unless, of course, it applies to Joe Biden. And what kind of debt are we paying for anyway? So let's ask some of the geniuses at NYU. These kids at NYU just graduated. Someone was doing an on-the-street interview with graduates from NYU. Parents pay $82,095 per year for their, as Rush used to call them, young skulls full of mush to study at NYU. These are some of the degrees that these geniuses want you to pay for.
Hello, my name is Jacob, and my concentration is environmental science and sustainable business.
Hi, my name is Lex, and my concentration is the performance of self.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Lee, and I study the sociology of environmental communication.
Hi, my name is Reed, and I study music business and gender studies. Hi, my name is Dominique, and I studied care politics with a minor in disability studies.
My name is Elliot Wright, and my concentration is art as a social mechanism.
Hi, I'm Georgia, and my concentration is dramatic writing and theatrical adaptation.
My name is Noah Loyacano, and my concentration is equilibrium or negotiated paradox.
Hi, my name is Sophie Lopez, and my concentration is titled Queering and Decolonizing Theater Practice.
Hi, my name is Maya, and my concentration is journalism, postcolonial studies, and psychoanalysis.
Hi, I'm Eloise. I'm graduating with a concentration in philosophy of science and theater.
Hi, my name is Juliana. My concentration is international business and fashion through sustainable development.
Yay! And they wonder why none of them can get a job after college. I mean, come on, equilibrium or negotiated paradox. Queering and decolonizing theater practice, the performance of self, care politics, art as a social mechanism, collective memory and political violence, and of course, the oh-so-useful gender studies. $82,095 per year for an NYU degree in equilibrium or negative paradox. So that genius can go work at McDonald's, where he will demand $25 an hour, then paradoxically fail to comprehend why nobody can afford a Big Mac anymore. This is what Joe Biden wants you to pay for. And Joe Biden announced recently he was, quote unquote, forgiving. And again, it's not forgiven. It's just taking their student debt and asking you to pay for it. But he was forgiving billions in additional student loans in order to buy more votes this November. And talk about election interference, but that's a separate issue. But it seems like even the mainstream media isn't buying it anymore. Recently, Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House's incompetent, inept press secretary, was asked about this most recent attempt to buy votes.
To follow up on the student loan debt forgiveness. Yeah. In the announcement, the Undersecretary of Education said, "We congratulate those borrowers on their due forgiveness." I'm just wondering why people who take out a loan to go to school, then go to school, why are they due forgiveness?
Thank God.
Everybody has a different story as to why they need student loans. Everybody has a different reasoning as to why they want to go to college. I cannot speak for everyone.
But why is forgiveness due to them?
What we have been very clear about is the system, the student loan system, needs to be fixed. The president is trying to do
in
a way.
Andrew, shut her up. I can't put up with her anymore. He is so right. Why are they due forgiveness? You took out a loan. You got to pay your loan back. It's that simple. Debt sucks. So what? We all have debt. Why should workers pay for college graduates' debt? And case in point, even Peter Alexander from NBC, certainly no conservative news network, but even Peter Alexander from NBC is starting to finally ask the right questions of Karine Jean-Pierre.
Just to put a fine point on it now, for the 4.7 million Americans who have received this debt relief, the average, as you said at the start of this visit, was $35,000 their relief has been for. So I guess, why don't those individuals who didn't receive $35,000 in debt cancellation deserve a $35,000 check from other Americans for what other means they would want to use?
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
You're talking about the
people who didn't go to college, so they're not getting debt relief, the $35,000 that they don't get because they didn't go.
We're talking about folks who are in debt who are literally being crushed.
Oh, my God.
Literally being crushed because they took.
Whatever.
Being
crushed. Let's be
financially. Okay, is that okay with you? Okay. But I know. But crushed financially.
I absolutely love that the press are finally asking these questions, but as someone is being literally crushed by credit card debt, or, you know, which, by the way, they incurred themselves, which is what student loan debt is, or, you know, medical debt, or property taxes, thank you, David Dennis, is the government going to give them $35,000 too? You know, taxes forcing retirees out of their homes, do they get $35,000? Is it maybe inflation Gee, that's killing people as it is. Try buy hamburger these days. Thank you, Joe Biden. Bottom line is they're trying to buy votes. That's all this is about. Karine Jean-Pierre says the president wants to build an economy for everyone. In other words, she wants to make everyone equally as poor and equally dependent on the government. The absolute fundamental first step to socialism. That's what this is about. Deb, you're on the John Whitmer Show.
Hey, John, how are you?
Oh, Deb Lucia, yes, fine, thank you. How are you? Hey, we've got, I'm glad you called, actually. We've got the filing deadline, what, noon tomorrow, correct?
Correct, for any position in the state of Kansas.
Well, I'm sure, for you, I'm sure one of the big things that you're no doubt focused on is trying to get folks to sign up as precinct committee men and women. I know my wife and I, we've got ours, we're filed, we're ready to go. But they can still do that if they want to. They go to the Secretary of State's website, they download the form, then they just have to get it notarized and get it down to the, or they could go down there. I suppose the office could do it, couldn't they?
Correct. If they just go, so you have tomorrow. So for the Sedgwick County Precinct Committee Man and Committee Woman, there are 303 precincts in Sedgwick County. And we would love to have all those filled. That would be 606 people. But right now we have about 180 people have currently filed. So there's a lot of openings. And the more people that file, the better it is for the Republican Party. If you go to the election office tomorrow, they can also notarize down there, and they have the forms right there, too.
Oh, that's
so you
can
download it, yep, and get it notarized, or you could just go down to the election office, which is on the corner of Central, Main, and Market Street. It's the courthouse. You just go down to the county building down there, and it's in the first floor, the election office, and you just go in there and file right there.
That's the old courthouse, right?
Correct.
Yep, that's what I thought. Yep, I've been down there many times to file for myself, and not only when I ran for the House, but to file, you know, just because we've been, my wife and I have been precinct committee people for, gosh, it seems like decades now. But that's, you know, that's really the fundamental way to get started if you want to get involved in public service or get involved in the party is at the precinct level. And when candidates want to get really involved in a campaign, that's who they call first is their precinct committee people. And help them get to, you know, hold meet and greets in their neighborhood, get to know their neighbors. They usually go to their precinct people first, and it's really a great way to get involved in the party.
It is, and it's a really important role, too. So, for example, last year we had a special election for whenever there's special elections for representatives or senators, state representatives, state senators, or county people, if it's a partisan race. So anything that's on the right now, anything you can file for right now, commissioner, those types of things, the precinct people select. If somebody resigns, something happens, they have to resign. The precinct people are the ones that elect the next person.
Yep.
And so it's a very important position. And we have, like I said, we've got lots of openings. And the precinct people are voted for. On the other thing that's important to remember is they're voted on in the primary. So they get voted on in August, and then that's when your election is. So we need people, though, to still file. There's still lots of openings. You can go down to the election office tomorrow and get it done.
We're talking with Deb Lucia, who's the chair of Sedgwick County Republican Party. Deb, I've got to ask you about something that you know, well, there are certain races I try to get involved in. I tend to avoid primaries, especially unnecessary ones, which is why I'm back on the air. But you know, then there are races that I do get involved with, and in particular ones where we've got solid conservatives running against Democrats. And I'm really starting to get annoyed with what's going on in the South Sedgwick County area with the county commission race. It's been annoying me for a while the way we have a Democrat in Sarah Lopez and a solid Republican in Jeff Blueball running against her. And you know my frustration with David Dennis and his continued public support, endorsements, and fundraising for Sarah Lopez. That you and I have had that conversation. I wish there was something we could do about it. There's really nothing we can do about it other than just absolutely shun David Dennis. But now you've got this most recent one at the Sundowner Parade on Friday for the 2024 Wichita River Fest. Lopez was there in her campaign T-shirts. And as anyone knows, the Wichita River Fest does not allow campaigning, and yet there she was walking in the parade with a whole bunch of folks decked out in campaign T-shirts. It's a clear violation of the parade's policy, on Wichita Festival's policy. I think it's an election violation. It's certainly, I mean, I just don't understand how she keeps getting away with this stuff.
Well, it's good for you to call it out so that people know. In that particular race, Jeff Bluebaugh is a solid Republican conservative, and that is who we need to elect. And I don't know why other people who say they're Republican would be supporting somebody else. I don't know that, but I don't know why. Because Jeff is a very good person. He's what we need. We need another conservative on the county commission.
Right.
We need somebody that's going to not raise taxes.
Thank you.
Ask the hard questions. And that's what we get. Some people on the county commission that are very nice, and but being nice doesn't get the job done all the time. You need people that can stand up and say, look, this is hard. This is difficult. I'm going to take the difficult stand and say no. And that's what we need, people that can say no. There are some people that just always say yes, and people are like, oh, how wonderful they are because they're saying yes, but they're not doing us any good.
Well, nice has caused my property taxes to go up 18%. I mean, nice isn't getting the job done. And you're right. I know there are tough decisions, but you cannot tell me that they're not areas to cut. Now, there may be cuts that might be a little painful, but that's your job. That's why we're paying you over $100,000 a year. And frankly, when you've got retirees that are at risk of losing their homes because you can't make a budget cut, that's unacceptable. And when you've got quote-unquote Republicans like David Dennis, who are out there publicly fundraising for liberals who are on the short list to be the next Democrat nominee for lieutenant governor, it is completely unacceptable. And I think we do need to call it out, and we need to call out any quote unquote Republican that stands up with her.
I agree. It's sad that it has happened, but all we can do is just make people aware that Jeff Bluebaugh is the guy that we need him. We need Jeff Bluebaugh to win. If you're in his district, County Commission, District 2. You have to stand up for Bluebaugh. And anybody listening, volunteer to walk for him.
Yep.
He needs help. He needs all of our help. But we have to tell everybody, Jeff's a solid guy. He's a good guy for that particular seat. And of the candidates that we have, he's the best choice if you're conservative.
Yep, I agree. Well, Deb, I appreciate you. You know I support you guys. I want to see the Sedgwick County Republican Party succeed. We have to have it succeed. You're the one standing up against the Democrats down here, holding one of the last large. I mean, we're the bastion, we're the buckle of the red belt down here that's holding on, especially with JoCo turning blue. If folks want to get involved, if they want to volunteer, if they want to donate, if they want to get activated, what's the best way for them to reach out to the party?
They can either send an email directly to SCRP, which is Sedgwick County Republican Party, SCRP chairman @gmail.com, or they can go to our website, which is sedgwick.gop, and there's volunteer sheets. You know, just sign up there, sign up for our emails, send us an email. That's the easiest way, and we check those every day.
And, of course, the third Thursday of every month, we have the monthly meeting, and they can come to that as well.
Correct.
Perfect.
Yes, the third Thursday, yep.
Deb,
Thursday of every month at WABA.
Thank you again, and just keep carrying on the fight.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Nice to hear you back on the radio.
Thank you. It's nice to be back. Mark, you're on the John Whitmer Show. Thank you for sticking around.
Yep. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You talked about the student loans.
Yep.
how do you compare that to like a child tax credit? Is that if they're willing to give money to, or basically you're not giving it to them, you're saying, hey, we're going to take less of an income tax.
Yeah, I mean, the child tax, well, first off, the one thing that's different is the child tax credit is a tax break you can take for qualifying children. And you're taking that break basically to, it's on taxes that you pay. The,
yes.
Okay, the student loan deal, you're signing up. No one's forcing you to take these loans. You're benefiting from the education. And so why should Joe Lunchpail have to pay for your student loan debt? And that's my issue here. And, you know, people also love to equate this with the PPPs. People love to say, well, why did we give people PPPs? Well, it's because the government shut down people's businesses for 2 years during a pandemic and made you put people out of work, and it was the only way to keep businesses from going out of business and destroying the economy. It's a little different because it was not, you know, you can't compare apples to apples or apples to oranges.
It was their choice to have a kid, right?
Again,
it was your choice to have a student loan.
Yes, again.
Yeah.
But this is a tax break on taxes that I pay, as opposed to something where.
So,
I'm taking out a loan for my own student loans. No one's forcing me to get these loans. I'm the one benefiting. Why should Joe taxpayer have to pay for my student loan debt?
Would you be up for a student loan tax credit?
On their personal income taxes? Sure. There's a big difference.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between that. Sure, let them write off some of their potential income tax. I don't have an issue with that. But that's not what this is.
That would be the, I would love to see someone push that scenario.
But that doesn't, problem is that's not what they're asking for. They're asking for, I'm owed because I got too much debt. Well, then you shouldn't be pursuing a degree in some of the, I mean, you heard what these NYU graduates
were. I agree. They take it out of control.
And so if you're pursuing a degree in existentialism and you can't get a job, well, then whose fault is that?
I mean, I agree there.
And so it's so clear. And here's the other thing that I fundamentally disagree with. The Supreme Court ruled on this. The Supreme Court specifically said the president does not have the authority to do this. And he's doing it anyway. And so even if I thought it was a good idea, when the Supreme Court says you can't, you can't. But he's doing it anyway. And that's...
How do bailouts work out with would it not be a bailout for student...
Bailouts come from Congress. That comes from Congress. Okay. Congress has the power of the purse. If Congress wants to pass that and go through the appropriations process, then that's fine. That's how that process works. But again... this isn't going through that process. This is going through an executive order through the president who doesn't have the authority. And that's why it's illegal. So that's,
I'm definitely agreeing there. But I would definitely like to see some sort of, I think that would be the end goal of you work, you pay into it, you get money back that you've paid in, and no one is eating it's your money to begin with, your taxes.
The problem with that,
and I think,
the problem with that, Mark, and I appreciate the call, but the problem with that, Mark, is it's the same thing with Social Security. You know, that's, we're paying into that now, and you know what's, I mean, if you're not in your 40s right now, and I maybe change that. If you're not in your 50s right now, you're not going to have Social Security. It's not going to be there for you. And I think the problem with this, with your idea, is unfortunately paying into it now, it's not going to be there in the future because government's just not, you can't trust it. They're going to spend that money. It's a novel idea, maybe a tax credit, maybe that's the way to go. But the president doing it unilaterally without authority is not the way to go. Donald Trump became America's most prominent felon on Thursday when a New York jury convicted him on 34 bogus counts of falsifying business records. That verdict has proven predictably controversial. New York's case against Trump has attracted bipartisan criticism ever since Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg indicted the former president last year. Of all the cases brought against Trump, New York's charges have always looked both the least solid and the least serious. Nevertheless, convict him they did. Joining us now to bring us an analysis of the verdict is constitutional law expert Paul Kaminar. He is lead counsel for the National Legal and Policy Center based in Washington, D.C. Mr. Kaminar is a public policy and appellate attorney who counsels clients in legal, regulatory, and public policy matters. As an appellate attorney, I can't wait to talk appeals process with him. Paul, thank you for joining us tonight. It's nice to have you on the show, my friend.
Yeah, thank you for having me, John. My pleasure.
So, Paul, was this a criminal trial or a political persecution? Because it sure seemed to me like it was the latter.
Yeah, it certainly was, in my opinion. I mean, this case was a farce from the very beginning. Keep in mind that the prosecutor here, local DA Alvin Bragg, ran for office vowing to get Donald Trump. So it started out with that kind of a political motive to bringing the case. And then he didn't do anything as prior predecessor didn't do anything about the case. It was only until Donald Trump decided to run for office that they decided to go after him. So we have it starting with a political vendetta, so to speak, and it was motivated that way, and it came through during the whole trial. You had the judge, Juan Merchan, who has donated money to the Biden campaign and a committee whose mission is to stop Republicans. That right there should have caused him to recuse himself from the case. I've never heard of a judge giving political contributions, let alone to the opponent of the guy who's he has before him in a criminal trial.
Right.
So that was amazing. And he said, no, I'm not getting off the case. Then the trial itself was replete with all kinds of errors in terms of the judge not sustaining objections by the defense on testimony by the prosecution witnesses like Stormy Daniels, who let her go on and on about the salacious details of her encounter or rendezvous with Trump that was totally prejudicial to Trump and had nothing to do with false business entries. And then the biggest error that I see was the jury instructions. I mean, it wasn't until the end of the case that the prosecutor finally revealed to the jury, oh, by the way, in order to find Donald Trump guilty, you have to find that these falsified business records was done to cover up one of three different other crimes that are felonies.
Right.
And take your pick.
Yeah.
As if this is a cafeteria menu.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Paul. How? Explain to me how that works, because, you know, those of us who spend a night at a Holiday Inn Express and think we're lawyers or watch an episode of Law and Order all know that concept of unanimous, jury must be unanimous. And yet here we have this case where the jury can disagree, and yet the judge considers it unanimous. Will we ever know how the jury voted? Will we ever know how this played out? How did they get to this? How is that even legal?
Right. Yeah, no, good question. Yeah, the only way we would know what happened in the jury room is if the media or reporter gets to a couple of jurors and asks them to explain how they got to their conviction.
Isn't there a jury sheet? I kept talking, you know, some of the commentators were talking. Will they release that, or is that
jury sheet? Yeah, jury sheet was a very simplistic thing where they had listed the 34 counts that were all the same counts, you know. Did he falsify records? And in the right column, it has either
You check the box either guilty or not guilty. So once you've found them guilty of one, it's just a matter of repeating it 33 other times.
Okay.
So it was a no-brainer. But there wasn't any sub-boxes to check. Which of the three felonies are you basing this on? And we would never have known, but in any event, if they split different ways, the judge would still say it doesn't matter. He's still guilty. So
but how is that legal if they disagree?
Well, we don't think it is, and we will certainly find out in the Court of Appeals, if not there, the Supreme Court. Now, the government says, well, this has been a law on the books here in New York. It's never been really challenged in the federal court or Supreme Court. They're claiming that, well, you know, you don't have to find that whatever the ultimate cover-up crime was, as long as you think he had falsified records for this crime. So it's kind of a stretch, to be sure. I mean, they said, well, it's like when you charge someone for breaking into a house with the intent to commit another crime. So they're saying breaking into the house is a crime, but it's an aggravated crime and a felony if you intend to commit another crime, such as robbing the house.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, whatever. And they said we don't have to say what that other crime was, but here it's not the same level of that kind of a crime because the judge specified there are three different crimes that he could have committed. And what the prosecutor is saying and what the media is saying is that, oh, his ultimate crime was to violate the Federal Election Campaign Act by influencing the election. Well, first of all, that was only one of the three choices. So we don't know whether they picked that one or whether they picked the one that said the business records were falsified for evading New York or federal tax laws. So they could very well have said that. But the way it's being spun by the prosecutor and the media is that this was done to violate federal election laws. All right, so let's assume it was. That was the reason why they charged that. Why is that doesn't hold up? Doesn't hold up principally because under our election laws, a candidate can spend as much money as he wants of his own money on his own campaign.
Right, exactly.
Whether it's to hire staff, whether it's to buy computers or whether to buy new suits so it makes them look good on the campaign trail, or whether it's to pay for a non-disclosure agreement so that the information doesn't come out that makes them look bad.
Right. If it's his own money, he can do anything he wants with it.
That's right. There's no limit. And if you look at the jury instructions, which I have under the paragraph about federal election law, it says it is a violation of the federal election law for someone to give more than $2,700 to a candidate. Well, that's true for the average Joe. So the jury might say, well, let's see, $130,000 for the non-disclosure agreement. Yeah, that's more than $2,700. So, yeah, that's what he was trying to violate. But wait a minute. He's not subject to the $2,700 limit.
Right.
As a candidate. So the whole thing is a mess.
Yeah, I know. When I ran for the House, the limits for Kansas House reps is $500, and I donated $2,500 to my first campaign. So technically,
there you go.
If I were in New York, I'd be guilty because we're talking with Paul Kaminar. He's lead counsel for the National Legal and Policy Center. Paul, let's talk sentencing. Sentencing is scheduled for July 11th, and looking at how this judge handled the trial, is there any doubt in your mind that Trump won't get jail time here?
Yeah, I think he probably will get some time because he already was found in violation of the judge's gag order, and the judge finally said, look, you do this again, I'm going to throw you in jail. So he's already shown that he's willing to do that. But even if Bragg asks for jail time, and even if Mershon decides to impose it, I have really no doubt that that judgment be stayed pending appeals. So
what the appellate court does that, right?
Well, Beauchamp can, but the way you do it procedurally is you first ask the judge, okay, Your Honor, you impose a sentence. Can you put a timeout on this from having it go into effect while we go on appeal? He can either say yay or nay. If he says nope, I want him to report to prison next month after, and it may be something else, maybe home detention, maybe probation, whatever.
Right.
Then you go to the Court of Appeals of New York and say, hey, look, could you put a timeout on this while we appeal the underlying conviction and sentence? And if they say, no, we're going along with Beauchamp, then you go to the Supreme Court and say, hey, look, you guys need to issue a timeout for both these lower courts because we have some serious legal arguments, and it doesn't make sense for our client to be carrying out a sentence if his conviction is ultimately going to be reversed. So he may do that. He may also do something like saying, he can impose, by the way, under the law for this particular crime up to 4 years. So he may say, I hereby sent you to 1 year in prison, but I will stay that sentence and put you on probation for 2 years, meaning that if you violate any terms of your probation, then I'm going to come back before me and then I'll carry out the imprisonment sentence. So there's various ways that this can go down. But in any event, I don't see, even if he imposes jail time with Trump singing a day behind bars or in home detention and keeping him off the campaign trail, whatever, until the appeal runs out.
And how long can that take? I know we're coming up on a break here, but how long? This whole thing, we're well past the election. We're talking probably end of the year, next year.
Well, yeah, the appeal will go well into next year in terms of briefing and having the oral argument and then filing a decision. So this will go well into next year.
Shame any Christmas. Yeah, well, folks, buckle up. It's going to be a while. Paul, thank you again for joining us this evening. If folks want to, you've got a lot of articles that you've written on this and other topics. If folks want to check those out, they can find it at nlpc.org, correct?
That's correct. That's our website. I appreciate any support we can get. We're a small organization, but we go after the bad guys and hope we can keep our work going on.
Appreciate you. Thank you again for joining us, my friend. Nice to have you on the show again.
Thank you. Anytime, John.
Thank you, Paul. Jeff, you're on the John Whitmer Show. Thank you for sticking around.
Hey, how's it going?
Fine, thank you.
I just really wanted to call without the utmost sincerity to just call and wish you guys a happy Gay Pride Month. I know that this is Steve and Ted's favorite month of the whole year. I know those guys have been together a long time.
They have been together a long time, although I have to be honest with you, my pride flag is red, white, and blue. So, but yes, if you're into Gay Pride, I commend you, and that's, it's a free country, so I'm happy for you. It's your choice, and I'm happy for you.
I also heard that it's one of Jed Chambers' favorite months of the whole year. Going to be coloring his hair. I hear that in the morning.
You should call the morning show if you want to talk to those guys. Call them. I'm sure they'd love to hear from you.
I want to get everybody excited. I hear they're going to have a couple of drag queens and doing story hour in the morning. It's going to be really off the hook over there at Steve and Ted, I hear.
I will let them know that you called and hope that they have a drag queen story hour on Steve and Ted. I think that would be hilarious. I doubt they'll do it, but hey, you know what? If they want to do that for their audience, hey, good for them. I won't do that for my audience, but hey, it's a free country. So, Jeff, but no, seriously, if you're celebrating Pride Month, again, that's good for you. My Pride Month, is red, white, and blue. So that's, hey, one in every crowd. Pat, you're on the John Whitmer Show. Thank you for calling.
Country. And real good guest tonight.
Thank you.
Statue of Limitation should have been mentioned on here.
Yes, you're right, because that Statue of Limitations is long expired even if he was guilty, and even if the, which the whole thing's trumped up anyway. You see what I did there? But the whole thing is bogus anyway. But you're right. The statute of limitations is long expired.
And the misdemeanor is what it should have been at
right,
the most.
At the most.
And don't forget where this all started. Cohen was his personal attorney, Trump's personal private attorney. His office was raided, and he was held in a cell for 3-4 months, and having his office raided, and his life looked over very carefully, and in essence, he was shown tax returns, and it said that you will never see your children again if you're not going to cooperate with us. And they turned him. The next day, he was on the daytime shows, how bad Trump is. They turned him like a North Korean prisoner of war.
Yeah.
And it was real dirty play.
If you know, by the way, thank you, Pat. Thanks for calling. And it's nice to have Pat back calling again. I missed you while we were on. I was taking guest hosts, by the way, Pat. But, you know, we didn't get to watch the trial. I wish that would have been incredible television. But if you watch during the day and the news, you know, mainstream news was covering it, if you're able to read the transcripts during the trial, if you watched any of Cohen's testimony, you could read and you could tell the lies. And it was so obvious when the defense got to cross-examine him how much he was lying. So, I don't know how a jury could find him credible until the judge gives the instructions. And then the judge basically gave them an out that said, well, it doesn't matter that he lied. It doesn't matter that he lied to you. The judge, in his instructions, basically threw this trial. The judge is the one who's to blame here. I don't blame the jury. The jury could not convict him. Based on the instructions given to the jury, what option did they have? That judge had it in for Donald Trump from the very beginning. I mean, just look at the gag order. There's just so many opportunities for an appeal here. They've got a dozen or more reasons, grounds for appeal. And I just, the whole thing is a sham. It's a joke. It's just unfortunate that we're having to go through this. But it is what it is. And hopefully when we come out of it, our republic is better for it. We'll take a quick break, and when we return, author Daniel Greenfield will explain why the DNC has switched to a virtual convention in order to protect Joe Biden. They're afraid for Joe. They got to protect him. It's the reason why he doesn't do press conferences. There's a reason why he can't answer a question. Now they're afraid of even a challenge at their own convention. Biden easily racked up the delegates needed to become the party's standard bearer. That's what happens when you rig elections. That was done by March, but the continued protest votes against him in Democratic primaries and his perceived weakness as a general election candidate has left open the door to the remote possibility of a surprise challenge and even a brokered convention when the party meets in Chicago in August. So Democrats, therefore, announced this week that President Joe Biden will be named their nominee for president virtually, which has basically deflated what little drama could have been expected at the Democratic National Convention. So why is the DNC so afraid of an open floor debate in Chicago? With us now to answer that question is Daniel Greenfield, author of Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left. Daniel, thank you for joining us this evening. It's nice to have you on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, Daniel, isn't this really about locking in the nomination for Biden and avoiding any kind of floor fight? Because, you know, there's a fair amount of loonies on the left, the pro-Palestinian, you know, Hamas folks, we didn't get our student loan bailout money. There's a chunk of them that, and maybe there's some that just don't think he can win, that would like somebody else.
I mean, there's absolutely going to be the leftist protests, riots, fork disruption, but I think that's not the real concern here. There's never been a candidate that's been this unpopular within his own party. You look at the polls in the past, you know, they're all going to vote for him. They all voted for him during the primaries. Not that there was that much of a choice. They made sure there wouldn't be much of a choice, but he is still really spectacularly unpopular among Democrats. And so many people, even in the professional Democrat class, the people I talk to, are absolutely nervous. They are worried. They don't think he can win. I mean, even David Axelrod, who was Obama's guy, yep, came out and at one point suggested, yeah, maybe this would be a good time for him to reconsider. So they're absolutely worried about their own people turning on him. They're worried if there's going to be any kind of option, if there's going to be any kind of opening for a floor fight, Biden could absolutely be demolished. So they're making sure they're doing this virtual roll call. They're using Ohio as an excuse. But they've done this all throughout. They've rigged the process because they know how unpopular Biden is, not with ordinary Americans, not with independents, but just within Democrats. Every time I talk to a Democrat, they absolutely do not understand why he's even the candidate.
Yeah, well, and clearly that's why Robert Kennedy Jr. is running as an independent, is because the Democrat Party basically threw him out because they considered him a threat. And it's why they're now attacking him incessantly, won't let him in the debates, things like that, which, by the way, I'm surprised they're even letting Joe Biden do a debate. I don't think he'll fare well unless they jack him up on cocaine or something. But what are the chances of Newsom, or even more implausibly, Michelle Obama or somebody swooping in at the convention? Is that, I mean, I think back in the day people were afraid of that. Is that even possible now? Or with this, is that now going to be not an option?
It would take a whole lot. You know, if those people wanted to come in, the big guns, they would have come in a whole lot earlier in the process. They chose to sit this one out. They decided that Biden's people had the party locked down. It was his turn. They're going to let him do that. You know, next time around, they're absolutely, you know, certainly Newsom is going to show up. He's got the money. He's got the inside track. But I don't think it's going to happen at this convention. You know, if they actually decide to remove him, it's not going to be a convention floor fight. It's going to be a private session where everybody important in the party is going to step forward and tell him, you have to step down now. This is your legacy. And by the way, you know, your son has got multiple trials and we can do something about that. So, and then that he's going to announce that he's very sick at this point. He's not, his health does not let him continue. And this is who his replacement is. But I would predict this is not going to happen.
We're talking with Daniel Greenfield, author of Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left. This isn't the only issue the DNC is worried about at the convention, though, Daniel. I mean, they're very concerned, I know, about this being another 1968 Chicago convention. That one, for the record, I wasn't even alive, but that one was mired in violent protests. They are really concerned about the optics of that happening again, though, as well, aren't they?
They absolutely are, especially considering Mayor Brandon Johnson, the radical leftist elected in Chicago, has made it pretty clear that he supports the protesters, which, of course, has put even more pressure on Biden to quickly bail out Hamas to avoid having the negative stuff happening at his convention. He's tried to give them everything he's wanted. They've wanted. He's tried to give the left everything they wanted since day one. He's turned his administration over to them, but it's just never going to be enough. And that's the tragedy he finds himself facing. He sold out whatever beliefs he had. You go back to the 1980s, 1990s, whatever he stood for, he's dumped all of those things. He was originally running as a moderate Democrat, then as a liberal Democrat. Now he's just a plain socialist, and still the left is not going to have him, let him have his moment in the sun.
Daniel, let me ask you this. Do you think Biden has, you say, you know, Biden has sold out, Biden has done this, do you think Biden has done these things, or do you think Biden is just doing what he's told? I don't know if he's cognitively aware of stuff, or if it's the people, Ron Plain, Valerie Jarrett, the people behind him who are really running things. I don't know if Joe Biden is actively making these decisions, or if they're just saying, okay, Joey, go in here, read the notes, then we'll get you an ice cream. I mean, I don't believe that he's actively making these decisions.
Honestly, we have so many of these 80-year-olds in the Senate in general, and those people just rely on their aides. And even the people who are in their 60s or their 40s, in many cases, they're relying on their aides. Their aides know what's going on. Their aides know what they're voting for. Their aides know what their floor schedule is. Some of these people really have no idea. And Biden has been that way for decades, even before whatever problems he had kicked in. So he knows what it takes to stay in power, which is to cut deals with everybody. And, you know, he relies on these leftists that he brought in, the Warren people, the Sanders people, the Obama people, to tell him what deals he needs to cut and what he needs to give the left.
So that, I think you're right. And I think when you look at like these campus protests over the war in Gaza, Biden's, you know, he gets disrupted nearly everywhere he goes. And I think these, the Chicago, the organizers of the Chicago convention are plotting on how to prevent and preempt these opportunities for heckling. I'm really curious, do you think we're going to see a normal convention, or are they really going to do their best to put on a show, but it won't look like what we've seen in the past?
There are going to be disruptions. If the disruptions get bad, I suspect we're going to see a semi-virtual convention. During COVID, we already got a virtual Democratic convention. We know what it looks like. We know they can put one on. I'm sure they're going to have celebrities waiting in the wings in some pre-taped segments with Biden top Democrats. And if things get messy, the networks are going to very compliantly cut to the virtual materials. They would never do that, of course, with Republicans.
No.
When there are disruptions that are going to happen with the RNC, they're absolutely not doing that. But with the Democrats, they're going to go along and they'll air the pre-taped stuff if they need to.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If this was a Republican, because I've been to two Republican national conventions, and I'm sure you're absolutely right. If this was the RNC, they'd have all the cameras trained on the protesters. And I think you're right. At the DNC, they'll play the canned foot. Fox won't, but the others will. Let me ask you, and I know this is kind of off topic, but since we're talking about, how do you think Biden's going to fare in these debates? Do you think he's capable of handling a debate?
Remember, unfortunately, Republicans once again fell into the usual habit of letting the left moderate their debates.
Yeah,
it's going to be CNN people.
I'm very disappointed.
Which means they're going to have the questions ahead of time. All they have to do is get Biden to memorize some of the same talking points he's been dispensing over and over again. They're going to ask him, do you feel Trump represents a threat to democracy? And he's going to go into his, and he's going to ask him, what are you going to do about the environment? And, you know, and student loans. It's going to be tilted to the left. And it's also going to be the same talking points he's been doing over and over again. And they're going to give him the questions they gave him to Hillary ahead of time. So as long as he can stay awake and at least marginally focused, it's not going to be a complete disaster, much as we saw in 2020. That's how they do it.
You've got the book out. It's called Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left. It's available on Amazon. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, you know, it was written in 2020. I was seeing all the insanity around, and so many people were in a state of despair. And the important message was that we've been dealing with this with the left for over 200 years. There was a left that was fighting the Constitution, fighting against George Washington, and they did it. They survived. America survived 200 years. We can survive Joe Biden, too.
You know, my wife and I actually were talking about this the other night, and you know, she was worried, and I think a lot of us are worried about what we're seeing today, what's going on in the country today, and I'm glad to hear that even so far back as our founding fathers, they too had to fight against the left. I think some of these battles that we're seeing now are a little more pronounced. I think it's a little more dramatic. I certainly think the culture war is worse now than it's ever been. But it's nice to know that some of these same fights were still being fought back in the 1700s. So, Daniel, thank you again for joining us this evening. Again, the book is Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left. Thank you again for joining us, my friend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ron, you're on the John Whitmer Show. Thank you for sticking around. Appreciate you joining us this evening.
Yeah, John. One thing I wanted to talk to you about is I think the people in the country, the politicians, are missing out, especially the right, on what's happening. The inflation is not the problem. Border is not the problem. There's many more problems out there, but the big problem is this Marxist bit that's in our colleges, in our schools. They dumb down our kids. And if you go into Google and Google Karl Marx manifesto, how many died on account of Karl Marx, it states millions and possibly billions. The Marxists, when they take over, they don't want your land. I mean, they don't want your people. They want your land, and they don't want the people. The people are the least thing that they want. If, for instance, when they went into Russia, they planted wheat 6 inches deep so it wouldn't sprout to kill and starve to death millions. And I don't know why the politicians don't get on this, especially the right, and tell them what's coming. You know, inflation might hurt you, but a gas chamber will hurt you a lot more. And that's where we're headed. Guaranteed, 100%.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is Marxists, it's so funny because if you look at what Karl Marx taught about education, he always said that education was a tool of the bourgeoisie, a tool of the capitalist ruling class. And Marxists right. have always argued that education was really just designed to reproduce class inequalities and to subvert essentially the workforce. And he always felt like education was a tool of the ruling class. And so I think it's so funny that now that's where they're teaching it is in the higher education. And unfortunately it's creeping down into secondary education. So I just think it's ironic that Marx, who taught as one of his core fundamentals was that the education system in and of itself was a tour of the rich and the bourgeoisie, is now they're literally teaching it in the very system that he was so opposed to.
Well, yeah, they've done down the young generation where, well, then you're worried about baseball and softball and track. They could care less about what's going on in Washington, D.C. and the basic rulers of this country, as you might call them today.
Well, and his whole concept was that you had to persuade the working class, the proletariat, to accept their subjugation as normal, and that was natural. And that they, therefore it was easier to basically to control them. And Rod, I appreciate the call, but it was so much easier, therefore, to control the working class if they essentially sat in their place. And so it's easier to control them if they're uneducated. And even though education fosters equal opportunity, that's not what they want. And that capitalism is a myth. Which is one of the reasons why Marxists hate the concept of capitalism, because capitalism builds everyone up and equal opportunity to let everyone rise above their station. But of course, that's not what Marxists want. They want this false equality that we're all equal. The problem is they want everybody poor and dependent on the government. And this false equivalency that says, well, we're all going to be equal. No, because there's still class systems within the Marxist system. It's just all poor with few rich people at the top. And that's what they don't want. But the sad part is they're out of touch. And that's what we're seeing time and time again. I mean, Bernie Sanders is a perfect example of a socialist who's a millionaire, who loves to rail against the millionaires and billionaires while he is a millionaire. But that's the hypocrisy of the left, and it's what we're having to find every day and deal with on a daily basis. Thank you for joining us tonight. We got a great show planned next week. Anthony Scaramucci, you're going to know that name. I'm sure you've heard it before. He will be one of our guests next Sunday. In the meantime, carry on, fellow deplorables.